That's Kari Hedlund. I'm Heidi Holton. Jesse Davis is still in the studio with us because our next guest is kind of in the your interest level as well, Jesse. And we're going to be talking about food and groceries and co-ops. In 2006, our guest John Steinman began producing and hosting a weekly one-hour radio show and podcast in Canada called Deconstructing Dinner. That show eventually became a TV and a web series. It's more about it's not just about food and recipes. John examines food systems through the perspective of both food makers and eaters seeking good food. His new book out continues this quest to understand that bigger food system. It's called Grocery Story, The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. John Steinman joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on your program.
So where are we reaching you today? You've just been on a road trip?
I am right now in St. Catharines, Ontario. I have spent the past 4 days driving from British Columbia all the way here through the U.S. and went through Montana, South Dakota, Iowa, and I'm now here for a few days before I head into New York State, where I'll be embarking on a three-month tour through food co-ops all over the eastern U.S. from as far north as Maine all the way down to North Carolina.
Wow. Well, let's hear a little bit about your background. What was it about food, besides needing to eat every day, but kind of looking deeper and deconstructing food, that interested you into kind of this becoming part of your life's journey?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. And, you know, I share a little bit of that story in the book because it really is what led me to believe that grocery stores are really underrepresented subject of conversation in the sort of, around the dinner table and also in the bigger kind of context. You know, for me, it really started with an appreciation for food, for loving to eat. You know, we all eat, but for me, I just grew this appreciation for the actual ingredients that I was bringing into my kitchen. And, you know, so that's where it began, this interest in local food, particularly because the fresher the food was, the closer it was grown close to home or manufactured close to home, the more it seemed to have flavor. It seemed to be a much more flavorful experience. And so it was from there I started to, you know, look at places where I could source that food. And at the time, you know, this is looking back at 2005 or even earlier, you know, farmers markets were certainly around, but they weren't as prevalent as they are today. And certainly finding local food at grocery stores was quite difficult. So, you know, I wanted to really figure out, well, what is it that can get that type of food into my kitchen more easily? And I started to turn my attention to grocery stores because, of course, this is where most of us access our food. This is where most of us buy food. In fact, you know, as I came to learn through my research into the book, 94% of all of our food purchases are through some form of a retailer, the other 6% being through farmers markets or community-supported agriculture programs or direct from farmers. So it seemed like this is a place to put attention into. And, you know, for me, I began writing about food and writing about local food, and it wasn't until about 2005 that I moved to Nelson, British Columbia, and learned about what a cooperative is and learned about what a food co-op is in particular, and very quickly became a board director of my local community-owned grocery store. And it was from there I started to really learn about the importance of a grocery store to a community and to the larger food system. But as you know, coming back to your question, it was really coming from a place of really appreciating food and wanting to make sure that the best possible food was available to me and to my community and to all communities, really. And that's where I turned my attention to grocery stores.
I love how you start the book talking about your kitchen and what was in your cupboards, your freezer, your fridge, and it's all just a list of homemade items, unlabeled jars, and things that were, quote unquote, illegal in the eyes of food inspection authorities. And but it was all your self-sufficiency that was, you know, kind of at the precipice of how your kitchen ended up. But you also talked about how exhausting that can be when you're trying to be totally self-sufficient and totally creating from the start, just kind of how exhausting that is and how you've sort of scaled back that process a little bit. Was that hard for you to scale back after you'd gone to that point of your kitchen?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, what you're describing there in the introduction from the book is really this journey I went on from having, you know, first started to learn about the global food system and just how complex and how complex it is and how much impact it has on everything, you know, on the planet, on people, you know, on our health. And it was from there it felt like I needed to sort of scale back my reliance on grocery stores. So this is before I even really became as interested in grocery stores as I am now. I decided the best thing for me to do was to try to source as much food as I could from my local community, from going direct to farmers. And part of that, too, the benefit of that was then I could be assured that every dollar that I'm spending on that food is going to end up in a farmer's pocket rather than anyone in between taking a little bit of that that dollar. So that was part of it for me. You know, it felt like I was also reducing my ecological impact by sourcing food directly from food producers. So as I describe in the book, almost all of the food that was coming into my house was coming from anywhere but a grocery store. So, you know, I had in my fridge foods that had no branding on it, no label in my pantry, nothing that could be recognized by, you know, a familiar a label of a package. And to do that, though, you know, to grow my own food, source my own food, as you say, I was sourcing illegal raw milk because in Canada, all across the country, it's illegal to sell raw milk. Not illegal to drink it, though. So, you know, that was something that I would organize. I organized a cooperative flour mill, which I'm still maintaining right now. But throughout all these little aspects of my life, it became overwhelming to be trying to source all of my food through these ways. And I started to look around me and notice that, well, yeah, I'm doing this. There's a few other people around me doing this, like small groups. But by and large, this type of lifestyle is likely not accessible to most people. And so it was from here I started to look into the grocery stores and say, you know, this is where most of us are shopping for food. How do we put this sort of same attention and intention that I'm putting into sourcing my food directly from farmers, how do we put that same intention into the grocery store? And sure enough, you know, some grocery stores excel at that more than others, where they're trying to shrink the distance from the farm to the plate. They're trying to put more money back into the pockets of farmers and food producers and food makers. And I use that term, food makers, to describe anybody manufacturing some type of food, whether it's from the farm or adding some sort of value through processing. And so, yeah, this is where I turned my attention, but it came from this place of being just exhausted at that lifestyle and feeling as though I needed to scale back. And it was hard to scale back because it was a really nourishing and fun experience. But from there, I was able to pick and choose, okay, which of these do I still want to include in my life? And which now do I want to start to turn towards the grocery store to rely upon? So now I have a much more balanced, I'd say, experience of sourcing my food, where I rely more on the grocery store than I used to. And yet I also still bring whole grains to a flour mill that's cooperatively owned by 25 other people in my community. And we use that flour mill to create freshly milled flour that is fresh and incredibly flavorful.
We're talking with John Steinman, author of a new book coming out, Grocery Story, The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. So, John, you also discuss a lot throughout the book about how farmers are in crisis. Are we speaking of all farmers, large, big productions, or just smaller farmers? What sort of is the level there?
I think generally across the board, farmers have struggled for decades. And, you know, I trace this back well over 100 years in the book to, you know, where a lot of this began, and I try to make the links between the grocery store sector having been a contributor of that in trying to drive prices down to the point where, you know, what farmers are receiving is not substantially enough to sustain a farm, and often farmers are reliant on off-farm income. So, you know, in the United States, a small farm is considered any farm that's selling anywhere from $10,000 to $350,000 worth of product. And I don't have the number right in front of me, but it's something like over three quarters of those farms rely on off-farm income. So, you know, this is a symptom of a food system that is well, a low-cost food system and a low-price food system, a food system that is trying to extract as much as it possibly can out of the earth and out of the people producing the food, keeping as much of it for itself, and then trying to charge as little as possible to the consumer, because at the end of the day, this is what's going to bring consumers through the doors of the grocery store. And so the consequence of this are farmers having to produce food in ways that often have to cut corners in order to actually sustain what they're doing. And so, you know, farmers, I think, of all scales are in crisis. I think there's some exceptions to that where, you know, you have farmers, for example, here in Canada who are part of a supply management system where they've actually pooled their resources together and are able to protect the price that they receive. So it's something that I know in the United States government wants to dismantle because it disrupts the concepts of free trade. But what these farmers in Canada, for example, do, which is dairy farmers, egg producers, chicken producers, they're able to set the price so that the price they receive from the market is exactly what they need to sustain what they're doing. And so by and large, in Canada, dairy farmers are quite well off. They're safe. You know, most other commodities don't have those protections, and so farmers are at the mercy of this ruthless, cutthroat food system. And often, you know, the conversation that we have around the sort of ills of the food system, they tend to focus on the sort of fast food companies, maybe the Monsantos of the world. And what I'm hoping with the book is to turn attention to the grocery stores, because at the end of the day, for us as consumers to become aware of these issues, these bigger issues that are facing, for example, food producers, this is the place we can experience this, because it's the interface between our kitchens and the farms and the food production. So this is where I think, you know, not only can grocery stores provide that level of education, but they play an important role in making sure that the dollar we spend on food can support the people producing it.
John, you bring up that grocery stores are really where consumers can kind of make their choices or make their, you know, their desires known. And I know here in the area, grocery stores have said, hey, we would love to have local products, but it's just so hard to connect with local farmers, the logistics of getting, you know, consistent product in. And I'm wondering if you found some innovative ways that grocers, both large and small, have been able to kind of tackle some of those logistical issues and get those local products into their stores and sell those products.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one that comes up pretty regularly, you know, in these types of conversations, because, you know, as you can imagine, the smaller a producer one is, the less efficient it is to constantly be bringing that fresh product to a loading dock of a grocery store, particularly if there's multiple grocery stores being sold to, which hopefully is the case, because having that diversity of markets is important to any small producer or any producer of any size. So there are some innovative models. I mean, when we do look back at the cooperative movement back into the 70s, when many of the co-ops that are around today first formed, and into the 80s in particular, there were these incredible stories and examples of distribution cooperatives or privately owned distributors that were supported by the food co-ops at the time, who were able to, you know, a food co-op as an example, able to order product from the local region that was all coming out of this one central warehouse. Now, similar to most other sectors of the economy, that too has been hollowed out and replaced with some very large national distributors. So in the sort of natural food sector, you now have groups like United Natural Foods, which is generally not shipping you know, local product anymore. It's shipping product all over the country. And so a lot of these distributors could no longer compete with the efficiencies of that large scale. Where you do have one example that I think stands out and is an example I hope would appear elsewhere across the country is not far from where you are, where you have the Cooperative Partners Warehouse out of the Twin Cities, which is run by the Twin Cities Partners, which is now the Wedge Co-op and Linden Hills Co-op in Minneapolis that have partnered together to form their own co-op, and they have this distributor co-op where local producers are able to drop off their product at that distributor, or the distributor goes and actually picks up the product from the farm and can drop it off at all the different co-ops in the region. And as far as I know, it's serving, you know, much of Minnesota down into Wisconsin, if not beyond there. So, you know, there's a great example. But certainly, you know, where I'm from in Nelson, British Columbia, we don't have a group like the Cooperative Partners Warehouse. And so this is a struggle. I guess the good news is that the more local the food system is, the less distance the farmer has to travel. And once again, I think if in some cases, if consumers are willing to pay farmers fairly, it might make sense for that farm to be able to deliver that product directly. It might make more economic sense, I should say, for that producer.
So the grocery store system has sort of changed and clearly impacted our expectations of the sheer colors of fruits and vegetables, the sizes that we see in the grocery stores. The story that I'm thinking of in particular is your experience seeing the fresh tomatoes. Can you tell us a little bit about this with the ethylene gas?
Yeah. You know, I my last project before I wrote a book was a television series. And so in filming that television series, which is called Deconstructing Dinner, we went and traveled to, well, all over the country. And one place in particular where we traveled was into the Central Valley of California, where by and large, most of the tomatoes that end up, particularly in the colder winter months, the tomatoes that end up on all of our dinner plates or in the fast food restaurants are coming from this area of California. And we went to go visit this farm, and I've never seen, you know, so many tomatoes being grown in one place. And what was so shocking were the harvesting practices. So the picking of those tomatoes happens when the tomato is rock hard and still green. So obviously for the reason for doing that is so that they can withstand the transportation. So these are going through these huge machines. If it was red and plump and flavorful and full of sugars, it would just collapse and turn into tomato juice by the time it got to our grocery store. So they pick these things as hard as a rock. They're green, and they end up going into these big chambers, into this facility, which we were also able to visit. And the moment that they're about to get shipped out to either the eastern part of the United States or up into Minnesota or even up into Canada, they'll start the ripening process artificially. And so they'll fill these rooms with ethylene gas. And, you know, I should say from everything I understand, there's nothing dangerous about the ethylene gas. It sounds dangerous. But it's essentially the same type of gas that is being produced by, for example, the tomato. If you put it in a paper bag or a banana in a paper bag, it'll start to ripen really quickly. So that's kind of what they're doing in these rooms. But it really shows the power of the food system to determine the harvesting practices and the processing practices that are happening, you know, upstream from the grocery store. So these tomatoes have been bred to be exactly the right size, to fit exactly into a box so you can have the exact number of tomatoes be shipped per load. And, you know, this is often dictated by the needs of the grocery store. And so, you know, this is an example that's used in the book of just the power of the grocery store to shape, literally, the food that we're eating. And I think a big part out of that, and coming back to why I first got into this in the first place, this subject of food and why I'm so interested, is it comes back to flavor. And without a question, you know, when you're picking any fruit or vegetable before it's ripe, it hasn't developed all those sugars, and the sugars is what results in flavor. And so, you know, what we are doing in being part of a food system like this, this long-distance food system, this much more industrialized food system, we're losing out on the excitement and enjoyment of food. And so this is where the local tomato becomes a real symbol of a different future, of a different type of food system than, for example, these tomatoes that often when we're cutting them, we look inside and they're white inside because they haven't fully ripened through the entire fruit.
Well, John, we sure would love to be able to talk to you more. Maybe we can catch up with you later in your tour. I know you'll be in Grand Rapids on July 8th. You'll also be in Bemidji in September. His new book is called Grocery Story, The Promise of Food Co-ops in the Age of Grocery Giants. And you can find more information at grocerystory.coop. John, thanks so much. And maybe we can catch up with you later.
Yeah, would love to do that. Thanks for having me on the show.